today, Dr. Ken Kassman. Ken is now emeritus professor of agronomy at UNL. Ken has worked in pretty much all the most important crop production systems in the world, with focus on increasing yields while preserving natural resources and protecting the environmental quality. He is best known for his research on crop yield potential, nitrogen and water use efficiency, ecological intensification, global food security, and as a co-author of the textbook Crop Ecology.
Thanks very much, Patricio. So I'll try to close this out with some more a more general perspective. This categorization scheme kind of falls out of some of the underpinning thoughts behind Ford Denison's work in Darwinian agriculture and applying evolutionary biological theory to understanding opportunities for crop improvement. And so we can think of three types of genetic control mechanisms with regard to stress or with regard to any factor. Simple control would be a single gene system expressed constitutively. Moderately complex system might be two or three genes. I mean, because it starts complexity starts ramping up very rapidly as you add genes, and especially if there's feedback control loops involved. And third, of course, would be those traits that are under polygenic control, often scores to thousands of genes. I mean, if you think about a drought, if you think about nitrogen fixation or yield per se. So if you then look at that, we can kind of start categorizing some of the traits that have been worked on successfully or in progress. So clearly, some of the kinds of insect and disease resistances are single gene control. A BT maize would be a single gene, for instance. Phosphorus efficiency, I think some of the citrate extrusion mechanisms are, some of them are considered to be single genes. Moderately complex, I'm not familiar where salinity research is here, but I think for effective salinity tolerance, it's probably more than one gene. Heat stress, we saw some very nice work by Dr. Prasad, but perhaps that's several genes, maybe, if we're lucky. And, of course, if you want to get horizontal resistance and broader resistances, it's going to be several genes. Now, complex control would clearly be things like drought, where there are different genetic systems that would confer tolerance at different phases of growth, each of which are probably not controlled by a single gene. Nitrogen efficiency would be another. Photosynthesis and respiration efficiency would also fall into this category. And the idea here is that for these traits, the question that Ford Denison raises in the first paper he wrote about this idea has to do with what can humans do through breeding that hasn't been done by natural selection. With the idea that if a single plant growing in competition with other plants benefits from a trait that's a single gene control, why wouldn't that have been brought into the advantage of that plant to survive and produce seed and become a successful genotype? As opposed to traits that confer advantages to plants grown under human management, where the goal is to maximize production of the plant community and not a single plant. And the best example there is the semi-dwarf gene, but simply one gene, simply lowering the height of the plant so that it's less competitive against its neighbors. But when you grow all plants in a plant community with that trait, you get much more of the dry matter allocated to grain as opposed to structural tissues. So we can then think of what kind of methods are successful in trying to genetically improve a given trait, in this case stress resistance. So if it's a simple gene, simple control, constitutively produced, obviously conventional breeding, and it's also a very good target for transgenic crops and gene editing approaches, because you can go in there, make a change, and heavily select for it in a breeding program or change it with transgenics. A little more difficult with a moderately complex control, but clearly the BT cassette would be something that fits in there, where you've used several versions of a gene to get broader resistance to an insect. But when you get to complex polygenic traits, I think there's a fundamental issue of how useful transgenic and gene editing approaches will be. And what we've relied on is brute force breeding, which I'll describe a little bit, and hypothesis breeding, which have been the approaches that have shown success in making significant progress. And I think it's important at various points in time, when there are competing ideas about what approach works best, to take a backward look at things and see where things fell out. And I'm not sure we do this rigorously enough or well enough in science. So, for instance, 10 to 15 years ago, there were two ideas about how you might improve drought resistance in crops. One involved manipulation of a single gene. Now, remember, earlier I would propose to you that this is probably not the optimal way to go. Probably not the way to put your eggs in the basket, whether you're a public sector funding agency or a private sector company. But in this case, one major seed company did. And another seed company took a different approach. I would call this the turbocharged brute force breeding approach, because it's not just lots of strip trials and lots of plots, but it's bringing in all the modern technologies that include precision phenotyping, genomics, molecular assisted, also modeling and genetic structure of whole genome and so forth. We can now look back. You know, in the heat of the battle, you can't really see clear, right? But it's important to sometimes stop and look back and say which one worked. Well, in one case, we have, in terms of the single gene, which I suggest you, Ford Denison first published this paper, was it 2002, Ford? 2003. So about the time that decisions were made on what to invest in. And that particular approach has not resulted in release of germplasm that is validated in large-scale commercial field trials and published in peer-reviewed journals. On the other hand, the other approach has resulted in release of drought-resistant hybrids. But I think here the key, and it's a tremendous contribution, but I think it's also sobering, because this work, the pre-breeding work from the final selection of hybrids and so forth, it's a 10 to 15 year project, and perhaps $100 million, who knows? And the result is a 6.5% increase. It's small. But it gets back to this idea that yields are already high on average. You're dealing with a system, and so getting a change in yield as you're moving up the yield curve gets harder and harder, kind of like the Red Queen concept. You've got to run faster and faster to stay in the same place. So this type 3 category means that there's really no shortcuts. There's few, if any, trade-off free trades. And we can, it's fun sometimes to just sit around and drink beer, whatever you like, with a group of people and start to try to think hard about what, if there are trade-off free traits. It's very, it's fun, but very difficult. The other point is I want to make is that useful genetic variation tends not to be large in this category of trait. And so, for instance, useful variation in nitrogen efficiency, polygenic trait, in transpiration efficiency or respiration efficiencies, probably not large, because, again, if a single plant competing against others would have a tremendous advantage if it could have nitrogen efficient transpiration, and especially controlled by a single gene. So I give you the example of the relationship between plant biomass and yield and nitrogen content. A wonderful seminal paper published in about 1990 by Greenwood and colleagues that clearly showed that there's a tight relationship. So these curves are were generated with many crop species, many cultivars, but there was a separation, C3 and 3-4, but it's a relationship between biomass end concentration and crop biomass. And this is really a time series during growth, so that the points towards the left where you have high biomass end concentration and low biomass is during the early growth vegetative stage, and these other points are later in maturity of the crop. What's beautiful about these kinds of relationships is how robust they are. And so these are data we obtained when we were trying to do a set of experiments with high-yield maize, growing the crop without any stress, best we could. And I show the dark line there is the Greenwood curve for a C3 crop. And I show our data, our actual field data, from four hybrids over two locations. That's quite robust, quite predictive. But the point is, because this is those curves were generated for all C4 crops, there's probably very little genetic difference in nitrogen efficiency with regard to relationships between biomass and nitrogen requirements. Brute force breeding, what is it? Well, this is numbers that Don Duvick came up with from, these are numbers that we included in a paper based on Ken Fry's work of looking at investments in maize breeding in the U.S. and how it changed over time. And what you see here is nearly a fourfold increase because it's all standardized to, I think, $1993. But the number of testing locations and the number of plots, look, it's 1,000 here. It's 1990s. Charlie showed 8,000 sites just for the Aquamax test. So the point is that investments in maize breeding today are probably even well above this. But it shows you that you're testing across a wide array of environments, and you're pretty much looking with brute force at, you're selecting for yield and yield variability. And the goal is to get the highest yield with the least yield variability in a targeted environment. And when you do that, it turns out you increase indirectly stress resistance. You bring it along. Because in general, growers are always, particularly in developed countries with high science-based, high-yield agriculture, they're always pushing crops, using technologies that if you're growing strip trials in progressive farmers' fields over time, those farmers are over time adopting improved technologies that push the crop into what Ty Stolenar called greater stress due to, in this case, plant population. So that when you look at era hybrids over time, these are hybrids that were commercially successful at different when they were released at different points in time. You see that the yield advantage is of the newer hybrids is much better at higher plant density because growers themselves were increasing plant density over this time. And plant density is a form of stress, each plant competing more vigorously against the other for resources. So I'm going to end with back to the main point of the talk, and that is how to accelerate improvement in stress resistance. Well, again, I think this turbocharged brute force breeding has proven itself. And that and this is for complex traits. I think hypothesis breeding has also proven itself, but this requires a significant investment in pre-breeding understanding of the physiological and biological factors governing stress resistance, and then simplifying on the far side of complexity to a phenotype that allows you to select for that. And the examples would be Graham Farquhar's and colleagues' carbon isotope discrimination, Ken Fisher and all's work on anthesis silking interval. These are phenotypes, and perhaps the Lawson-Sodrus hypothesis about plasticity, which would be a selectable phenotype. We've heard about improved models with capacity to simulate genetic controls clearly. So there's nothing new here, really, and you've heard so much better detail about it in the earlier talks. But I'm going to end on the last point, that I think to accelerate progress, we all have to do a much better job of prioritizing investments in research, both in the private, but I'm going to really focus on the public sector where I've worked. And so I don't think we do a good job at looking at probability of success. If USAID is funding significant work on single gene approaches to complex traits and stress resistance, we're not using public sector funding very well. And if you're going to also be using a hypothesis breeding approach, if you don't have a robust selectable phenotype, again, money not spent well. Second, I think we need to think about scale and magnitude of impact, because you might accept greater risk in your investment if the potential scale and impact is huge. But the point there is we need better quantitative ways to estimate what that scale and impact might be. Finally, I would say we need to require an explicit time frame of publicly funded research and rigorous monitoring of progress towards milestones. Because I've seen projects, one example I can give is nitrogen efficiency funded by USAID that seems to go on and on and on without a rigorous time frame and monitoring, et cetera. And I think we're, given what Patricio said at the outset, we're in a race against time to meet food demand. There isn't sufficient funding for agricultural research. We've just got to do a better job on prioritization. And I'm going to ruthlessly, Ford, you promoted your book. I'll promote mine. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Precision phenotyping? With I guess what I mean is robust selectable phenotype. That if you have a complex trait, and you're going to do a brute force breeding approach, well, if you're going to do a targeted selection criteria, you need to have a very robust phenotype you can select for. So the carbon isotopes discrimination helped tremendously in the wheat, drought-tolerant wheat in Australia and elsewhere. Anthesis silking interval in corn, breeders could really focus on that. And I'm excited that perhaps if a plasticity of a trait is a phenotype related to stress, that could also be used robustly. Does that answer your question?
All right, just a couple of quick comments here at the end. Again, we circulated a form for the continuing education credits. If anyone still needs to fill that out, please do so and return it here to the front. Also, continuing programming for the C3 division this afternoon in this room is the rapid oral session at 1:30. And then the general poster session from 4 to 6 in the exhibit hall. So, thank you.